There's even a scene where the girls run downstairs and they're yelling, Merry Christmas, Merry Christmas. They're not saying Happy Holidays, right? There's religion in this film. Welcome to Respecting Religion, a BJC podcast series where we talk about what's at stake for faith, freedom for all in 2020. I'm Amanda Tyler, Executive Director of BJC.
And I'm Holly Holman, BJC General Counsel.
This week, we're going to take a look at a recent announcement from the Trump administration about constitutional prayer in schools. And in our second segment, we'll explore the greater context of how this new policy fits into our existing understanding of religious expression in the public schools. And be sure to stick around for our third segment when we share what we are seeing, reading, watching, and thinking about when it comes to respecting religion. So as we sit down each week, we are looking at a recent event, something that caught our attention, but we don't think it got quite enough attention.
Right.
And we want to talk a little bit more about the event and how it came to respecting religion.
Well, for sure, when we see a headline announcement that the president is going to announce new guidelines about constitutionally protected prayer in schools, we will be paying attention.
And we first heard that on January 3rd because he made that announcement at a political rally called Evangelicals for Trump. And we're in an election year. At that point, we're in the middle of an impeachment trial or about to start on the impeachment trial. And so we thought, what is this new guidance and what will we say about it?
Right. And it was quite unexpected in that, as you note, all these other things are going on. And unlike some other topics that we discussed and will discuss in this podcast series, there had not been a recent development in the law, no recent cases or high-profile events on the topic of religion in the public schools. In fact, I had to scratch my head and think, wait a minute, the last time the Supreme Court made an announcement on this was like in 2000 or 2001.
So nothing new that we could see that was precipitating this announcement, no new development in the law. President Trump decided to time his announcement of the new guidance on January 16th with Religious Freedom Day. This is a day that's been recognized by Congress to commemorate and celebrate the passage of the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom. And past presidents have observed the day, issuing a proclamation.
It's a very positive thing to note our country's history on religious freedom. Yeah. And that's a good thing that balanced out the concern, I think, about what we heard at the evangelical rally, which appeared to be stating that there was a real problem that we need to address.
So it's Religious Freedom Day. President Trump says he's going to have an announcement in the Oval Office.
Right.
January 16th, just for the context of our listeners, not just Religious Freedom Day, but also the first day of the impeachment trial.
Right.
So most of the media was focused on that, and when the media showed up in the Oval Office, when they got to their question and answer, that's what they wanted to talk about.
Right. I actually went back to watch the announcement in the Oval Office much later than when it happened. When it happened that day, of course, I wanted to see the guidelines. Let's see what kind of guidance he's going to put out, and is there something that we really we need to analyze and communicate to people about any big change. But when I went, we'll talk further about the substance of the announcement and the guidelines, which turned out not to be as exciting as they were promised. But what was really interesting in going back and seeing the Oval Office announcement is that the president was surrounded by people that you could see a quite diverse selection of people. And as he talked to them, they reflected religious diversity in America. And that was nice and exciting because we're used to big religious liberty events in our country reflecting religious diversity, and we haven't seen that as much with President Trump.
Well, and of course, our public schools reflect religious diversity.
Exactly. It made sense.
I think some surveys show about 90% of Americans go to public school. So that's true now. It was true then. So really, public schools touch on all kinds of Americans' lives, whether they went to public school themselves, send their children there, work in a public school, their taxes go to the public school, maybe they even vote in a public school on a primary or general election day.
That's right. One question you might ask yourself is, why do we keep having announcements about religion in the public school? And I would agree with you. One of the reasons is just that public schools are so prevalent and important as institutions in our society. And they also reflect where we can get religious freedom right, because they demonstrate the role of government. You know, public schools are arms of the government, and they have responsibilities to not advance religion, not promote, coerce, kind of put their thumb on the scales about religion, and at the same time to respect religious diversity and religious expression in appropriate ways.
So we are going to get a little bit later in the program into some of the specifics and the context of this, but when we pulled out the guidance, and the last time the federal government released such guidance like this, we think was in the Bush administration, George W. Bush administration, although the guidance has been on the Department of Education website throughout and, of course, been available to public schools. But kind of doing a side-by-side comparison, this looks like the same set of guidance with one exception from 2003, right? This isn't new as far as anything in the law that's stated here.
Right. The overview of religion in the public schools and protecting religious expression, if you want to put it in those terms, or protecting religious freedom, however you want to refer to it, the rules have been pretty consistent, clear for a long time. There have actually been consensus efforts of private parties, groups, nonprofit groups, religious and civil liberties groups across a broad spectrum, including BJC, going back to the 90s. So I knew as I was listening to this that whatever guidance would be issued would have to either reflect or show significant changes from this long history of guidelines that have been promulgated and have been distributed through the country, through public schools, going back to the 90s, and then some changes, guidelines that were issued in the George W. Bush era, I think some in 2003, maybe some tweaks in 2005, but there hadn't been significant changes since then. And as soon as we got the newly released Trump guidelines, that was a relief to see that they were largely the same.
Yeah, and we think it's a good thing for people to know what their rights are, that the more that we have education about these issues and that we know what the Constitution both allows and prohibits, that we'll do a better job of respecting everyone's faith freedom. You know, we also think it's important to acknowledge that schools sometimes miss the mark. Sometimes there are misunderstandings and misapplications of the rules, both in the form of prohibiting private prayer by students, but also in overreaching and having government sponsorship of prayer. We think that education and communication solves a lot of these problems on the local level.
That's right. I think a positive aspect of this announcement, what came out, and this reiteration of a lot of the common sense rules that reflect court decisions for many years, was that you see this fairness, this balance between religious expression and government being neutral toward religion, and you saw the diversity of ways that the issues come up and how they can be resolved, and an appreciation for talking about the rules again. It's really important that everyone knows what the Constitution allows and what it prohibits to avoid the kinds of problems, some of which that time in the White House Oval Office gave us a chance to explore.
And I do want to read a little bit just from the kind of preamble, if you will, to the guidance itself. They give an overview of governing constitutional principles. And again, these are the same principles that were issued back in 2003. But it bears repeating because it talks about what the line is, the line between government-sponsored and privately initiated religious expression is vital to a proper understanding of the First Amendment's scope. As the court has explained in several cases, quote, there is a crucial difference between government speech endorsing religion, which the Establishment Clause forbids, and private speech endorsing religion, which the Free Speech and the Free Exercise Clauses protect. So that states very succinctly the core to this message. And then it goes on to remind the schools here about what is not permissible. And I think that that's a good thing to lead up front with that, to be sure that the school itself is not running afoul of that line. And then it goes to talk about what is permissible in more detail.
So the substance is important to reiterate. It was not substantially different in these guidelines as it has been in others, although there was a change about certifying and how they collect information. We've seen efforts like that in prior administrations. So there's a little bit of differences that people should pay attention to that schools will have to respond to from an administrative level. But overall, what we saw is the need to occasionally, maybe more often than one would think, to highlight those rules that you just mentioned to make sure that we can work through challenges that public schools face. I thought it was interesting as the president engaged the visitors he had surrounding him in the Oval Office, they illustrated this dynamic of someone saying their religious freedom had been harmed or they had faced this horrible problem in the public school about an issue that really could be quite easily resolved. One striking example was a young boy that had worn his ashes on his head on Ash Wednesday to a school where he was in the minority. He's Catholic, but he was in a school that was primarily Mormons, and the teacher said, get that off of your head, and he was upset. But it turned out that it really was a lack of understanding, not so much a violation of his religious expression as misinformation.
Yeah, I was struck by that example as well, and so did a little bit of research and found some articles that came out at the time about that, about the very swift response from the school itself in issuing a repudiation of this action. They actually put the teacher on administrative leave for a short period of time. And then the teacher came forward with a public apology about what a misunderstanding it was and how terrible she felt because she didn't realize that it was ashes. She thought it was dirt. And the way that that local community came together on that problem and acknowledged a need for increased religious literacy and education for their workforce.
I don't think that the handful of examples that were on display that day show a harsh secularization happening in the public school. I think it shows the diversity of religious experience and the challenges that school administrators have in accommodating religion and protecting religion in diverse ways. And a lot of times these things can be resolved quite easily. We also saw in some of these examples the persistent, I guess, claim of those to restate a problem in ways that exacerbate them. So you had a student who had conflict with his school because he had a voluntary group of students praying, but they did it in study hall in a way that became disruptive because the crowd was so big. And so they said, you need to move your voluntary student prayer activity before or after school. Well, it seems like that would be fine.
Seems reasonable to me.
It sounds reasonable. But the student insisted that they have that right during the school day. Well, a student can't really do that except if there isn't a time that that's appropriate and fits within the school day, meaning the time's not all taken up by curricular activity. And eventually they worked out some kind of agreement and settlement. But here we were many years later in the Oval Office on TV acting as if there was a major religious freedom problem that had to be resolved.
And acting as if this set of guidance was bringing something new or bringing something that would solve these problems immediately. As you said, they've already worked themselves out by the time of the photo op in the Oval Office. And I think that that's one of the things we need to watch out for when we see this is an exaggeration of the problem or misrepresenting facts. And in the president's statement itself, he said, in public schools around the country, authorities are stopping students and teachers from praying, sharing their faith, or following their beliefs. You know,
that is not helpful to the religious freedom conversation. Releasing guidelines that show the rules, that educate people about how to get it right, that is very helpful. Demonstrating the diversity of religion in public schools and the good people from a variety of religious perspectives that are involved in the schools, whether they are teachers, administrators, or students, is helpful for understanding how we can support public schools and demonstrate religious freedom in the public schools. But it's extremely unhelpful to exaggerate problems and claim persecution by misrepresenting facts or making them into bigger stories than they should be.
I think we also have to be careful about on the opposite end of this spectrum, claiming that this guidance somehow is really pushing religious expression. Again, the idea that we're informing people of their rights is important. You know, one aspect, the one new piece of this guidance is a new requirement for states to provide a process for the filing of complaints if there's a student or a teacher who feels like their right to voluntarily pray in the public schools is being infringed on, that there's a new complaint process that must be set up by every local education agency and to go all the way up to the state. It's a little surprising in this anti-regulation environment of the Trump administration to add a new requirement on the states in this way. But it also, in a way, puts a thumb on the scale to say you need a complaint process if your right to voluntarily pray is being infringed upon. But you don't, there's no comparative requirement if the government is establishing or sponsoring prayer in some way for those who are who are affected by that to complain.
And it shows a imbalance of concerns on this important proper balance that we have in the public schools. And it's bizarre to me because there can't be that many problems about not being able to voluntarily pray. As your predecessor often said, as long as there are math tests, there will be prayer in public schools.
So I love that.
We know that there are many ways that voluntary prayer happens and does so in ways that are not disruptive, not at odds with anything that the public schools are doing, and in fact are just consistent with our religious liberty norms.
So we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about what those religious liberty norms are and how groups for decades have been coming together and finding common ground on this to help with education.
So let's talk, Amanda, about why, if there's not a lot of new coming out of the guidelines, that it's so important to keep attention focused from time to time on these guidelines. And I'll tell you, from my perspective, it's because people can't avoid using religion to sort of make their political point. And we will continue to hear, as false as it is, that God's been kicked out of the public schools.
Whenever I hear that, I'm like, what kind of God do you have? The God I have is way too powerful to do that.
That's right. So yeah, that's a problematic statement from a lot of perspectives. And your reaction from that theological perspective is so important. And I imagine many Christians feel the same way. Like, how does that even work? But thinking about it legally, I can say that it's important for us to remind people what the law is with regard to religion in the public schools. And a few years ago, we celebrated the 50 years of religious liberty guidelines in the school. In a way, you could say that instead of thinking about when God was kicked out of the public schools, you can say when the Supreme Court made very clear that the government itself should not sponsor religious exercises in the school. It was the 50-year anniversary of the landmark school prayer cases, as they're known. School District of Abington Township versus Shemp was in 1963, and Engle versus Vitale in 1962. And those cases dealt with states' laws in Abington's, a state law requiring daily Bible readings in public schools. The court found that the practice in that case violated the Establishment Clause as applied to the states. The decision is often coupled with Engle, the 1962 decision, which decided that the state could not have state-written prayers recited each morning. In those cases, the court explained that the Establishment Clause operates to ensure religious liberty differently from the Free Exercise Clause. So what the court did was they made clear that it's not just about not coercing people in religion, but that, in fact, this was a quote from the case, when the power, prestige, and financial support of government is placed behind a particular religious belief, the indirect coercive pressure upon religious minorities to conform to the prevailing officially approved religion is plain. So you don't need a coercion is like in a physical or punishing way. It says, you know, kids, you have to pray or you're going to be sent out of the room. It's enough that the school itself is taking a position and sponsoring religious practices that would violate the Establishment Clause. So those cases are quite, they make a lot of sense when you think about them, and they really protect, even though they're Establishment Clause cases, they really, in my view, protect the freedom of religion, free exercise of religion, because they don't interfere with the students' own religious training at home and in their selected churches or religious backgrounds that represent their families.
And that makes a lot of sense when we think about how BJC approaches the two clauses of the First Amendment. We know that true faith freedom requires that the government stay out of the way.
Exactly.
And it also makes sense that it doesn't require an actual punishment for it to look like the force of the school, given the authority. I mean, we hear all, you know, they're relying on their teachers for a grade. We hear things about the, quote, right, permanent record. You know, all these things that are being shaped in these early years and just the vulnerability of children. It's important that the state not overstep. I love how you talk about these cases as maybe the beginning of guidance, because people sometimes focus on the don'ts in the case, but they also, when they're talking about that, they're laying down the law, the line, they also talk about the do's. Like, you know, in Abington, they said no mandatory Bible readings, but that's when they first started saying, of course, using the Bible in an instructive, non-sectarian, non-devotional way is perfectly fine,
right.
And we're seeing the successor to that conversation continuing now as well.
That's right. The court acknowledged that religion and the study of religion is well said to be an important part of education, but it was addressing a practice at the time that had the state leading in religious exercises, and that is not good for religious liberty.
So with the Supreme Court kind of starting this role of putting out guidance about what you can and cannot do in public schools and still serve religious freedom for all people, we had groups coming together in the decades following that to try to interpret that and to take that legal guidance and put it into common sense language that could be used in schools, in communities, to educate about what that proper line is.
Yeah, I've heard our good friend Charles Haynes, who started the Religious Freedom Center that we worked with so long at the museum, talk about this many times, and he's a great historian as well as resource on religious freedom. And he talks about sort of the swing. So maybe after the 1960s decision, maybe there was sort of an overreach, and so there was sort of a scrubbing of religion sometimes from these schools where it shouldn't be. I don't know of that situation, but it makes sense historically that that would happen. And then you have a pushback to ensure that religion is treated fairly in the curriculum and properly, and that individual religious expression is respected, and that this upholding of Establishment Clause values does not mean that there's no student speech and student-led practices where that fits in the school day. So yes, I first learned about the guidelines when I came to the BJC in the early 2000s. There was already a tradition of BJC involvement in coalition efforts to have consensus guidelines about religion in public schools. And they very much reflect these ideas we've been talking about here and that exist in the recently newly released guidelines.
New and improved.
Yes. So those guidelines show what students can do and what teachers and school administrators can't do in order to protect religious freedom for all. And in my time here, I would say that issues arise persistently in the public schools, not in great numbers, I don't think. I really think the fact that we have had steady guidelines and not a lot of changes really makes it likely that most public schools can get it right. But of course, a lot of schools don't have attorneys on staff, and you know, issues come up from time to time that they haven't seen. I think that's probably especially so where a school is homogeneous, right? So if you're in a school district where the culture and geographically there are a lot of Christians of the same, of the kind of general same perspective, they may not have a lot of reasons to stop and think about why they shouldn't have some kind of school-sponsored practice that maybe is a kind of a holdover from, you know, before Levi Wiseman made very clear that, no, you shouldn't have government-sponsored prayer at graduation. That was in the, you know, in the 90s. But then in another area, you might have so much religious diversity and proper application of the rules, and then some student who has a particular religious need makes a claim to do something or gets corrected for doing something, and the school has to learn, wait a minute, no, this person, we need to accommodate this religious exercise, but they just hadn't seen that before. So I really do think the geography and culture of different communities makes a big difference, as well as the school board, the school system, the principal's all's dedication to educating and making sure that teachers are prepared to handle all these situations.
I think the guidance does a good job, and I think it does such a good job of emphasizing the do's, the things that students can do, and BJC has more resources, and I would refer our listeners to bjconline.org/resources, and the very first choice there is religion in the public schools resources, and they can see some of these guidelines. I think we should not forget, though, about that there still needs to be guidelines and understanding about not doing government-sponsored religious exercise in schools, that in our experience, we see probably equal number of concerns on either side of that, that it's
right.
Not so one-sided just about misunderstanding about free exercise in schools.
That's right. And we're lucky to have watched a long time and have relationships with organizations that do a lot of litigation in this area. And some of them tend to be on one side or the other, not necessarily disagreeing with the guidelines, but they might come to the aid more often of either students who whose expression has somehow not been treated correctly, or on the other hand, students who were coerced through some practice at the school that really does violate these constitutional standards.
And you know, we are having this conversation. Just last week was Public Schools Week, which is a fairly recent effort to build bipartisan support in Congress for public schools and pass resolutions and things like that. I took the opportunity last week to write a piece for BJC's Medium channel talking about Public Schools Week and what we're talking about here. So our conversation is well-timed.
Public School Week is as you said, it's a fairly new endeavor that is also reflected on the Hill as we sit here looking across at the Capitol building. Members of Congress in both the House and the Senate have the opportunity to join bipartisan resolution in support of public schools. And while it's not focused on religious liberty, BJC has promoted these resolutions because the public schools, as I said earlier, are a place where our religious freedom principles are really played out and have the opportunity to be understood in ways that really make sense. Why government itself should not advance religion, but why we must respect religious diversity and expressions of the students. The resolution that the members of Congress signed talk about public education as the foundation of 21st century democracy, and that there are places where students can be educated as citizens of the United States, and recognize that 90% of children in the U.S. attend public schools. So just recognizing that rich environment for the raising of our children in ways to help them understand and live together is really important. And the way they learn about religious freedom, and we work through these challenges from time to time, can have a great effect on our country.
And sometimes it's the training ground, really, for living in our religiously pluralistic society, a way to encounter people of religious difference. And I do think, when we think back to the Oval Office announcement, I think we saw some of that importance in some of the other people who were there in the announcement. And we had some people who were religious minorities, not just the boy, the Catholic student in Utah, but also a Jewish student and a Muslim girl, and talked about the problems that they had encountered in their schools with people understanding their religious difference, and hopeful that not just this guidance, but also increased religious literacy can really help them, and help not just them and their exercise, but their students and their ability to understand and work with people who have religious difference.
Absolutely. It's important that we recognize religious diversity, and whether you're in a community that has just a little bit or has a lot of diversity, when you think about that, it makes you more likely committed to these values that are reflected in the guidelines.
Yeah.
So that each child has same kind of religious freedom.
Yeah, and I was also reflecting during public school week about the fact that I went to public school.
I went to public schools.
Yeah. Yeah. And in our experience, you know, we both grew up in Baptist churches and religious households. That was an important part of
right.
who we were. It helped bring us to BJC as interns early in our life. But I was thinking back, and it was prompted somewhat by the guidance when it talked about that students have the freedom to use religious themes in their schoolwork. Mm-hmm. And my senior year in my English class, Mrs. Patterson had us write a short story. And I was inspired to write a short story from Mary's perspective about her grief over her son's death. I have no idea what Mrs. Patterson's religious background was, but I was able to write that paper because it was something important to me, and I got an A for it. And so I just was reflecting on how this really does work and how this plays out
right.
in my history and in communities across the country.
Right. And I'm really thankful for all of those lawyers that came before us, Amanda, working on this at BJC and other organizations, to ensure that guidelines reflect what maybe you took for granted as a child writing this story, which is that, you know, religion is not to be excluded from things. At the same time, you couldn't write that paper and get an A if the topic was something else. And so we learn about these disputes from time to time, and sometimes they are misused to make us think that things are much worse than they are. And in fact, the guidelines reflect a lot of common sense and respect for religious freedom in the public schools that the rest of society could learn from.
Yeah. So we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back for our third segment. And we actually took our own advice this week and are going to talk about where we saw religion respected, including at the movie theater. So before we talk about religion in film, Holly, you had an interesting article this week that I think relates to what we've been talking about in this episode.
Well, I had an article, meaning I had a church member come up to me and say, "Hey, Holly, did you see that article?"
We said this happens, right?
It happens, and it was interesting. I think I would have seen this, but maybe I wouldn't have read deep enough into the article to kind of hit on the important church-state issue that arises. But there was an article in the Washington Post about meditation practice in schools, and the headline was, "Teachers Use Meditation to Inspire Calm. Imagine a voice coming from your heart." Now that sounds something that might get our attention. The story was about a particular middle school in Northern Virginia where they have been experimenting with I think it's like about a 3-minute exercise with 11 and 12-year-olds, sort of getting ready to calm themselves before class. I thought it was interesting because in Virginia, we do have a moment of silence statute. So That has been challenged and upheld. Of course, a moment of silence that says you don't have to, you can use it for any reason. It recognizes the importance of taking a moment before you start the school day, is not a violation of the Establishment Clause. It's not the same as school-sponsored prayer. But this story was about a practice that goes longer, and teachers talk about the benefits to students that help them be more relaxed, less stressed out, actually kinder to their fellow students. And this story kind of reflects that it's experimental. And right now they're just seeing how it goes. But the article did mention that at least a couple of kids have opted out and seem to tie that to the idea that some people have raised the question about whether or not this was a school establishing the religion of Buddhism or Hinduism, religious traditions that have a long interest in practice of meditation. Of course, there's also that practice in Christian history as well. So sometimes it's not always clear when, what the religious practice is, and it's not always a Christian practice that is the cause of some kind of controversy or question in the schools.
What stands out to me from your description of the article, and we did talk about this some in the office this week, is this idea of the opt-out, that seems to be, again, public schools on the ground figuring out these novel questions as they come up. It doesn't sound from the description on the faith that there's on the surface here that there's much faith or religion that's involved in this meditation practice. It's certainly not. That's not the reason that the school is bringing it in here. They are seeing other benefits as far as a calmer, kinder student body. But if that exists, then students have the option to exempt themselves.
And I think that's typically a practice when the school is working with some kind of alternative curriculum. There are certain core classes that you don't opt out of, and then there are other offerings that either because they're just extracurricular, or maybe religiously sensitive or sensitive to families, as in some kinds of sex education curriculum, there are these opt-out provisions. And then it's, of course, the school's responsibility to make sure they don't treat students that opt out in any different way, but that they have somewhere else to be that doesn't harm their development. But anyway, we'll keep our eyes peeled for that and look forward to hearing what the school finds is the result of this practice and to what extent it becomes controversial in the arena of what is religious and what schools can do and can't do.
So we both have now seen one of the films that was nominated for some Academy Awards.
So one reason we had to go see this film is because there was religious controversy about it. And that may be overstating.
So
because
the film is Little Women before we...
I was going to let the listeners guess.
Oh, no. I'm sorry.
That's okay. Little Women, of course, got all kind of critical acclaim at the Academy Awards show. It is a beautiful film that we can talk about. But even before I saw it, one thing I was curious about was its treatment of religion. And that's because a good friend of mine was visiting recently, and we were catching up. She's a friend of mine all the way back from law school, and we have a lot in common as far as our backgrounds and shared values, but we have some differences too. And she was catching up, asking about our work and saying, oh, everything now seems so divisive and not just partisan, but just kind of rancorous. And she said, did you see that Wall Street Journal article that said God goes missing in Little Women? She said it was like the author was trying to get people riled up because there wasn't an explicit show of religion in the way that the author expected. And the funny story is that she learned about this article at the table with her family, where her husband read the story and said, oh, this sounds ridiculous that Hollywood would scrub religion. And her husband had not seen the movie. And she and her daughter said, wait a minute, we saw that movie. And they what had stood out to them was the beautiful reflection of religion in the movie.
Yeah, and you know, you brought this article to me and I said, well, Little Women's been on my list anyway. This seems like a good conversation for respecting religion. And I have to say I agree with your friend and her daughters. I found religion really from almost the very beginning of the film and some of the language that was used. They talked about sinners and prayer and God bless you. There's even a scene where the girls run downstairs and they're yelling, Merry Christmas, Merry Christmas. They're not saying Happy Holidays, right? There's religion in this film. And I think in some ways, I read the piece in the journal by Charlotte Allen, and it seems to me what she's most upset about is the movie doesn't talk about Pilgrim's Progress, that prior book was a major theme in the novel by Louisa May Alcott, and this director, Greta Gerwig, doesn't mention that. And she seems upset that Pilgrim's Progress doesn't make an appearance here. And for that, she's right. I didn't hear anything about Pilgrim's Progress in the film, but that doesn't mean I didn't see evidence of faith and religion in the movie.
It's a reminder to be careful about headlines and to seek more understanding and conversation. I think that we can read this article more charitably to say, you know, the author is an expert on this literature and is just noting differences and different treatments. I mean, there have been several movie versions of Little Women, and so perhaps this is a difference. But I don't think it should provoke anger or hostility about what's going on in the culture as if God is not welcome in culture, film, public life, as we see it in many ways.
And in the film itself, you know, I found it to be a beautiful depiction of this family and of love and of sacrifice, all of which are religious themes. This might just be a case of an editor gone awry in adding this provocative title. We'll hope that that's the case, but we'll keep looking for evidence of religion in the world around us, including in films and books and articles and the like.
As I said, I read the article before seeing the movie and wondered about the idea that the movie emphasized a different topic. I think the author of the article said in Ms. Gerwig, the director's version, that the moralistic preaching had switched to a different topic, feminism. I thought, oh, here we go. Now there's something else to kind of provoke division, to say that not only was God wiped out, but they elevated feminism. Of course, I was skeptical of that because of my own religious upbringing, teaching, and understanding of Scripture, where I don't see conflict in the basic idea of feminism and equality before God and religious teaching. So what I was already sort of thinking, I don't know. I don't know that I will believe this, that there has been some kind of replacement here, but let me go see the movie. And in fact, that did come across. Both their religious courage and teaching and formation that applies to all people, men or women, even in a story that's told in a particular historical era where women struggled in so many ways and did not have the same rights that we often take for granted today. Particularly, there's that scene where the mother says that she prays every day for patience, that doesn't come naturally for her. But it shows her humility, her humanness, brokenness in striving to do what's right. And I think that is a timeless part of living a Christian life. And the fact that that was in a conversation also about repression of women seemed very natural and spiritual and reflective of God being real in that movie.
And when Ms. Gerwig was talking about this film, you know, and in other reviews, it talks about this being an illumination of this book, that she was faithful in many ways to the story, but it was told for our time. So my hope is new era of feminists, men and women who are feminists, will go and see this film and see that feminism and religion are not mutually exclusive. That's and right. Find ways to incorporate it in their lives. So I am grateful not only to the author of this piece for raising it, but for your friends who are providing some good topics for our conversation here on Respecting Religion.
And a good reminder to all of us to take a deep breath and listen to each other, continue to think critically, but not in ways that jump to conclusions.
Well, that will do it for this week's episode of Respecting Religion. For more details on what we discussed today, including links to the articles we mentioned, check out the show notes that go with this episode. Join us next week when we'll be discussing another recent announcement from the Trump administration governing how faith-based groups partner with the government and the impact that has on Americans who receive government-funded services. We invite you to join us each week on Respecting Religion. We release new episodes in this series every Thursday, and you can see a list of all of our episodes by visiting bjconline.org/respectingreligion. Be sure to subscribe to the BJC podcast so you won't miss an episode. We're on all the major platforms. And let us know what you think of the podcast on social media. We're on Twitter and Instagram at BJC on the Hill, and you can follow me on Twitter at Amanda Tyler BJC. Also, visit our website at bjconline.org to learn more about how we've been protecting faith freedom for all since 1936. And join us again next week for a new conversation respecting religion.